Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And today, as listeners of this show know, a major emphasis since our inception has been the economic forces changing the Heartland economy, especially globalization and trade agreements. Our area is a microcosm of these forces that played a major role in the election of Donald Trump as president. And there's been a really excellent analysis written over the weekend in the New York Times about these forces. And it's one of the best I've read. And again, as listeners know, I've read a lot on this topic. And I'm really pleased to have as my guest today the author of that article. His name is Jonathan Weissman. He's based in Chicago and writes on economic and labor policy. And again, for our listeners, I strongly advise picking up a copy and reading this or going online. Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Well, this is, some of our listeners may be surprised, but these issues predate Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah.
Start at the beginning on this, where this all started, and we'll just take our listeners through this whole process right up to the present day.
I mean, it's hard to say where it all started. We have to randomly pick a point. I could have gone back probably to the Carter administration and deregulatory efforts during Jimmy Carter's presidency. I kind of chose 1992 because that election pitted George H.W. Bush, who was kind of a classic Republican preppy guy from Connecticut, via Texas, had a home in Kennebunkport, Maine, and he was running against a young Democrat named Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton had this idea that he was going to be the first post-Cold War president, and he wanted to not only situate his own administration and the United States in the post-Cold War world, but he wanted to create a foreign policy and a domestic policy that meshed. His idea here was he wanted to promote free trade to bind together capitalist democratic countries, but in doing so, he recognized the risks and he wanted to expand the opportunities in the United States and the social safety net. Clinton was obviously elected in 92. Bush got his 38% of the working class vote, which is pretty much what Republicans were kind of always getting, 38% of what we call the non-college educated worker. And Clinton set about doing what he tried to do. One of his very first efforts was to ratify NAFTA. And you probably all remember, not everyone's old enough to remember Ross Perot talking about NAFTA and that great sucking sound that would be jobs going to Mexico. So it's not like Clinton wasn't warned about this, but he had this feeling that if he expanded the social safety net, if he spent billions of dollars on worker retraining, worker resettlement, and was mindful that the economy would always change and that people were going to have to get retrained and find new jobs, that he wouldn't be punished for this. And it would help the world and the country by stabilizing Mexico, by decreasing illegal immigration, an issue that was big in 1992, as it is now, and that everybody would be happy. But the biggest problem was that only half of his equation happened. He did do the globalization that he promised to do, but the expanded safety, social safety net really was truncated with the demise of Hillary care, the expansion of healthcare to everyone universally. He also wanted a huge worker retraining program, and that also didn't pass. And then once the Republican tidal wave of 1994 brought a large Republican majority to Congress in 1995, then all of the well-meaning and well-intended programs that he hoped to aim at the working class never came to pass. But hey, the economy boomed, and they went about, they said, well, the economy is doing great, let's just keep going. And then the most fateful decision that Clinton made was to help China ascend to the World Trade Organization through what was called permanent normalized trade relations. Once that passed, then the acceleration of the deindustrialization of the United States, especially in the Midwest and the upper Midwest, Great Lakes region, really, really accelerated. And that happened beginning the year 2000.
This issue, of course, our listeners know out in this region, our whole listening area, near where I live in Galesburg, Illinois, NAFTA is still a dirty word. As a refrigerator plant that was profitable at the time, moved to Mexico back in the early 2000s. And even now, John Deere is under pressure for laying off workers, but also moving more and more of their production over the border to Mexico. So this is not only an issue of the past, but in the present and likely the future. It seems like the Democrats, and the title of the article is How the Democrats Lost the Working Class. And I think, based on my knowledge of it, that is what happened. There seemed to be a thought that, well, we'll give them retraining programs and they can retrain and they can. Was there thinking that they could retrain in the productive jobs, make the same amount of money, have the same benefits? It seemed like the other alternative was to move, uproot and go where the jobs are, which.
And I think that there was, you know, it's interesting because I spoke at length to some of the economists who worked for the Biden administration, who certainly remembered that time. And yeah, there was a sense like, hey, you know, if a Whirlpool plant, you know, moves to Mexico or to China, you know, hey, it's only like 40 workers, but hey, everybody's going to benefit from much lower costs, that there was a sense that they looked at workers more as consumers and they didn't understand the psychological impact of plant closures. If they thought, oh, this plant only employs 40 people or 100 people, what's the big deal? But what it turned out to be was that these plants had huge psychological benefits to a community. Communities were built around these kinds of plants, not only jobs, I mean, because there were supplier jobs, there were electricians and plumbers and things like that, that worked at the plant, even though they weren't employed by the plant. But there was a sense of identity around, a Whirlpool plant or an auto plant that was in your community, even if most people didn't work there. And I think that that was the miss. I think that was, when you talk to Jared Bernstein from the Biden administration, he would say that was the biggest miscalculation. They just didn't understand the psychological hit that these plant closures would take, and consequently, the big political hit that the Democrats would take.
Well, you talk in the article about the dignity of work, and I was struck by, and listeners know, I had students researching this with some of the Maytag employees in Galesburg. And what they missed the most beyond just the job was the sense of community within the plant, of getting to know people and going to worker activities and all. And now with the advent of social media, and we've got this this phenomenon of people being more isolated and all, this just seemed to contribute to that, this isolation of people when they lose their jobs and they lose the social aspect of the factory as well.
Yeah, I mean, think about your union halls. How much those union halls social centers, centers of community, and you know, as union jobs moved away. You know, it's funny you mentioned Mexico, but I'll tell you, China was a much bigger impact. And China also reflects on those Mexican jobs, because remember, a lot of those Mexican plants became assembly plants for pieces that were being made in China, shipped to Mexico for final assembly and brought to the United States. So the real, the huge sucking sound wasn't actually NAFTA. It was China's ascent to the WTO. And we are still really, really reeling from that, even now.
I'm glad you brought up the consumer aspect, because I think that's a big part of this. That I think, you know, the economists, and you point out in this article that, you know, hey, the fact that we can pay lower prices for television sets, and they, I mean, there's no question that a lot of goods you would pay less for something made overseas versus here, that the benefits of that would override the loss of community. But how is that working now, Jonathan? I mean, is there a bigger sense with people that are they willing to pay a little more for stuff made here? Or is this consumerism idea still very prevalent, even through Biden's attempts to address some of the problems in these working class areas?
That's an excellent question, because I think if you asked somebody, hey, would you be willing to spend a little bit more on an American-made product, considering the impact that that product has on community, that person might say yes. But then we saw the political impact of inflation. The price sensitivity of American consumers is pretty volatile. I think that Americans want to have it all. They want to have low prices, and they want to have American-made goods. And it's a little difficult to square that circle, as companies have found, as we all have found. I mean, the fact that we got, like, it's not just like televisions, it's like your shoes and your t-shirts and all those things used to all be made in the United States. They're not anymore. And if you suddenly decided you want to get your t-shirts made in the United States, I mean, the cost would probably double. I'm not sure if Americans are ready to really spend the money that it would take to bring all of these consumer goods back to the United States.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very delighted to have as my guest today Jonathan Weissman, who's a reporter based for the New York Times, based in Chicago. He writes on economic and labor policy and issues, and he's written one of the best recaps analyses of why the Democrats lost working class voters over the weekend in the New York Times. If you subscribe, check it out. If you don't, it's worth subscribing to just to read this. Again, the article called "How the Democrats Lost the Working Class." It's really a great history of some of the economic and political changes that have hit the country, but mostly in our region. As people know, these changes are a direct cause, I think, partly anyway, of Donald Trump winning. When you look at the number of Obama-Trump counties in the Midwest, especially in our listening area, and that brings me to Barack Obama. I remember him campaigning as kind of an economic populist, addressing these issues. He used the Maytag workers in his famous speech in Atlanta. And then, of course, he ran a very populist campaign against Mitt Romney. Did he try to address this issue at all, to right this at all?
I think in his first couple of years, when the Democrats had large majorities in Congress, he was somewhat bedeviled by the financial crisis. But look, the fact is he intervened to save the auto industry, and he made a big show of saying this is an iconic industry that we cannot lose. It's not just about the number of jobs here. It's the hit to prestige if the United States no longer has an auto industry. He did a lot of interventions. He created the Consumer Financial Protection Board, which was supposed to be a real hit at the credit card companies and the predators who caused the financial crisis. And he obviously, in those first few years, he was very much focused on expanding the social safety net. The Affordable Care Act, which was controversial at the time, was possibly the largest expansion of the social safety net that we've had since Medicare in the 60s. And right now, we kind of take it for granted that the Affordable Care Act is there, that we won't be kicked off our insurance for pre-existing conditions, things like that. But, you know, like a lot of Democratic presidents before him, he became enamored with his position in the world. And, you know, Donald Trump has this, you might call it a gift or you might call it a curse, but he doesn't really care what the rest of the world thinks. So he views everything through the prism of, how does this look in the United States? How does this look? Will this bring jobs? Will this not bring jobs? I mean, the Democratic presidents tend to try to make decisions that balance the United States' role in the world with domestic political considerations. And the second Obama term really was consumed with his position in the world and his possible place in history. So as you remember, you know, he spent a lot of effort trying to get that nuclear deal with Iran to make sure that Iran didn't create a nuclear weapon. He spent a lot of effort trying to address climate change. He was really the first president to try to address climate change. And he did something that a lot of people don't even remember. He tried to get something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership would have been the largest free trade agreement ever. It was going to unite every country that borders the Pacific Ocean together in a set of trading rules that would isolate China. And the idea was, if we all were trading with each other, we won't be trading with China as much. It will stabilize the globe. It will stabilize the Pacific region. But it was kind of tone deaf because it was a time when people were tired of the world, tired of the globe, and tired of free trade. So all of that effort that Obama made to secure his place on the world stage and in world history were undone almost immediately by Donald Trump. It's quite remarkable because really not much else was done by Obama. You know, I was thinking one area in that article that I did not explore was the 2004 election. You know, in the Bush, George W. Bush era, that was when the deindustrialization of the United States really picked up steam. And you could see just the employment of in manufacturing just dropping off a cliff. But instead of the Democrats going after George W. Bush in 2004 for the deindustrialization question, you know, they nominated John Kerry, who was reporting for duty and was supposed to be the wartime candidate, and everything was about Iraq. And look, Iraq was extremely unpopular. But once again, the Democrats just forgot that the working class was their base, and they just didn't even bother trying to appeal to them at a time when I'm sure the working class was all ears, or was certainly aware of what was happening to the factories and plants in their communities.
Remember Trump, hearing Trump on satellite radio in 2016, and he was talking about trade and infrastructure. And I remember my thought was, wow, he's going to make inroads with that message. Especially because his opponent was Hillary Clinton, whose husband passed NAFTA, was there with the creation of the WTO, China. And it did hurt out here. I mean, these river counties, factory towns in Iowa, all along the river, all switched.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm a political reporter. I have spent a lot of time up and down the river on the Iowa side and down and such. And of course, those were once Obama strongholds.
But I think what's interesting here is, you know, Trump really didn't do much, honestly, to appeal to working class voters when he was in. And here comes Joe Biden, probably the most pro-union president we've had, and all the programs he's passed, it didn't really manifest itself in this election to any degree.
It is remarkable because so much of Joe Biden's economic policies were correctives of policies of previous Democratic presidents. You know, basically, once Robert Rubin, the Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, started setting policy, it was really designed to boost financial industries, to produce these booming stock markets, and really benefit people on the coasts. And it worked for people on the coast. Joe Biden comes in, he's Scranton Joe. Scranton was the perfect illustration of what happens to a mid-sized industrial city when all the plants leave. He had this working class appeal, and the policies that he pursued, Buy American on steel, you know, and most people probably don't even know that when the infrastructure bill passed, it included a measure insisted upon by Joe Biden that the steel for all of those girders and bridges and such be bought from American steel plants. That was a huge boon to the domestication of the redomestication of the steel industry. These proposals in the Inflation Reduction Act, not proposals, they're laws, in the Inflation Reduction Act, which were designed to bring, you know, to create a boom in alternative energy, wind power, solar power, all those things. They also had pro-labor measures that gave extra tax credits to companies that hired union labor, that used the union apprenticeships. And there was even these very large tax credits for companies that would locate their new plants in areas that had been deindustrialized. Did it do any good for Joe Biden? No, it didn't. And I think some people would blame Biden by saying he just didn't get out and tell people about this. I don't really buy that. I mean, the fact is that if people were feeling the impact, you know, they wouldn't need somebody to translate their own good feelings. There's a truism in political journalism, which is, you can't tell somebody he's doing worse than he actually is, and you can't tell somebody he's doing better than he actually is. He knows how he's doing. But I think that the problem is inflation. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, if you get unemployment from 9% to 5%, you've given 4 percentage points of Americans jobs. That's good. If you have, if inflation goes from 4% to 12%, 100% of Americans are going to feel that. Inflation has always been a political killer. And Joe Biden and, in extension, Kamala Harris aren't the only politicians that have been killed by inflation. Look at what's happened in Britain. Look today. It's Monday, January 6th, and we just saw the Prime Minister of Canada resign his position as the head of his party under pressure because inflation still continues in Canada. So inflation is a killer, and Joe Biden just didn't do enough to control it.
We just have a couple minutes left. I thought one of the great points you made that really I had to stop and really think it through because it meant a lot was you talked about the major upheavals in this country, the Iraq War, COVID, terrorism, the Great Recession. And I would add an issue like immigration. They hit the working class hard, but the elites emerge unscathed. You throw in the fact that none of the bankers were during the Great Recession lost their jobs or were sent to jail when people were losing their homes. You've got this groundswell. And I think when looking at it in those terms, it's not a big surprise that we've had the political fallout we've had.
Yeah, and you cannot forget COVID. You know, in COVID, working class folks, they didn't just get sent home. They lost their jobs. And even those who got their jobs back or found other jobs, they went through that upheaval where, you know, the elites, they just worked from home on their computers and hardly missed a beat. In fact, the elites in the country actually did better economically during COVID because they were working from home, doing the same job, earning the same amount of money, but, you know, not buying their lunches anymore. So and not paying for their commutes. I just think that there is a sense, and it is a well-founded sense, that no matter what happens, war, recession, apocalypse, pandemics, the elite always come off fine, if not better, and then the workers just take it on the chin. And I don't blame Joe Biden for that. But I think that the sense that the system is rigged to help the people on the coast and hurt everybody else is pretty well founded.
And that was Bernie Sanders' message. Are there? I got time to throw in one more here that I wanted to ask. Are there Democrats out there that you see that kind of get this now? I know there's some latecomers that are all jumping on the bandwagon, but are there people out there you see that grasp this issue and can articulate it and perhaps be leaders moving forward and have this issue at the forefront?
It's funny, since that article came out, it popped out online on Saturday, I've heard from actually a number of Democrats, Democratic officials writing me saying, wow, that was, you know, that was an eye opener. We need to all think about it. And I think about people like, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Elizabeth Warren. You know, they have the right message on this, but, you know, one's from New York, one's from Massachusetts. I mean, I think the Democrats need to find somebody to emerge from these communities themselves who can really speak to it. And at this point, you know, it's hard to see that. I mean, maybe Ruben Gallego, the new senator from Arizona, who grew up in Chicago, actually, and can speak to, what is now the backbone of the working class, the Latino man. Maybe Gallego will emerge as a powerful voice. Maybe John Fetterman will. But at this point, the Democrats really kind of are at sea. They've got basically 3 years to get their act together and find a leader who really can win back the working class. Because as we have seen, it's not enough to just win the elites and the people who live in the big cities and the suburbs, especially if you're now losing the working class of color. If you can't keep black men and you can't keep Latino men in your camp, you just don't have the numbers.
It's a numbers game, absolutely. Jonathan Wiseman with the New York Times has been my guest today. He wrote an article over the weekend called How the Democrats Lost the Working Class. Really required reading if you want to get what's going on as it applies nationwide and to our region. Jonathan, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me, Robin. It was fun.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at wvik.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.